Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, May 2nd, 2024. I'm your reader, Mary Frances, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Taking a look at the Sioux City Journal front page today, top of the fold, Reynolds signs flat tax bill into law. Supervisors set insurance funding source. And Entering the Vortex, new film festival set for this fall. And we'll start with the top story. Reynolds signs flat tax bill into law. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signs 3.8% flat income tax into law. Iowa taxpayers will pay a flat 3.8% on their income next year under a law that Governor Kim Reynolds signed on Wednesday. As she lauded the transformation of Iowa's tax code Republicans have ushered in over the last 6 years. The law, Senate File 2442, builds on a tax overhaul that Reynolds signed in 2022, which set Iowa's tax rate on a path to a flat 3.9% tax by 2026. The latest change sets a lower tax rate and brings it sooner than initially planned. Republicans have continually pushed income taxes lower since they gained control of all the state's legislative levers in 2017, pointing to annual budget surpluses as evidence that Iowans are paying too much in taxes. Simply put, we've comprehensively transformed our tax code and dramatically increased our competitiveness within a few short years, Reynolds said as she signed the bill in her office at the Iowa State Capitol on Wednesday. At the same time, she said, conservative budgeting practices have kept us living within our means and allowed us to continue making historic investments in key priorities of Iowans. Iowa's top income tax rate this year is 5.7%. The new law makes a number of other changes to Iowa's tax code, including tweaking property tax rules following up on a law Republicans passed last year. It also allows county supervisors to eliminate county compensation boards, which set the salaries of elected officials in the county. If county supervisors eliminate their compensation board, they would be tasked with setting those amounts. The law is expected to cut income taxes and reduce state revenue by an additional $1 billion over 3 years. And will reduce revenue by about $100 million each year from 2028 to 2030, according to the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. If tax receipts come in below what the legislature spends in any year over the next 5 years, the new law states that half of the difference will come from the Taxpayer Relief Fund, which is estimated to have about $3.66 billion by the end of this fiscal year. The tax law was passed in the last hours of the legislative session this year, after Republicans in the House and the Senate spent much of the session crafting an agreement. Several Democrats in the House and Senate voted for the bill, but Democratic leaders opposed it. They argued the overwhelming majority of the benefits would go to the richest Iowans, and said they were concerned about long-term impacts of waning revenues. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst said during the session that the changes give no benefit to around 500,000 Iowans who do not pay income taxes. They're not giving the money back to all Iowans. They're giving the money back to the wealthiest Iowans, middle-class Iowans, and leaving 500,000 Iowans in the dust, she said. So our argument will be continually that this overwhelmingly benefits the rich. Those who are at the top bracket get five figures of benefit. Those at the bottom, $5. Another bill Reynolds signed into law on Wednesday will create tax incentives designed to attract major businesses to set up shop in the state. The new law, Senate File 542, creates tax breaks for mega sites, which will be business developments that occupy at least 250 acres and have at least $1 billion in investments. Up to two qualifying projects could be approved under the bill. Businesses that qualify for the sites would be eligible for an investment tax credit a refund on sales tax for construction services, and a withholding tax credit. They will also be eligible for local tax breaks. To qualify, a site must meet the following criteria: be located on at least 250 acres of land and have a total cost of $1 billion, be primarily engaged in manufacturing, bioscience, or research and development, create jobs, pay a wage above a certain rate, and offer benefits, and not have a history of law violations. The program will cost the state about $97 million in the first year if all eligible projects are approved, and it will cost around $18 million in subsequent years, according to the Legislative Services Agency. The bill was proposed last year, but it did not pass. Reynolds told reporters on Wednesday the state officials have been using the prospects of the tax credits to attract businesses to the state. Quote, "We've used it as a competitive tool for us to land significant economic development projects in the state of Iowa," she said. Next story from the front page. Supervisors set insurance funding source. Property insurance for new Woodbury jail to be covered in FY25 budget. Woodbury County has determined a funding source for the new law enforcement center's property insurance, said Board Chair Matthew Ung on Tuesday. Previously, it was publicly discussed that no funding source was determined for the more than $170,000 insurance premium. The Law Enforcement Center Authority approved a property insurance coverage quote of $177,455.28 from Federal Insurance Company in April. The service offers fire, marine, casualty, accident, and health and property insurance services. Steve Schultz of Gallagher Insurance, which has presented insurance proposals for Woodbury County in the past, said 15 carriers were approached, and property insurance premium quotes ranged from $146,000 to $226,000. The lease stipulates the county must pay for property insurance for the jail facility. Previously, Woodbury County Budget Director Dennis Butler said the money had not been budgeted for in the 24 budget and would have to be pulled from reserve funding. On Tuesday, Ung shared that due to the most recent jail complications, pushing the completion date to July, the expense would come out of the FY25 budget. Quote, per Gallagher, the insurance would not go into effect until there is an occupancy certificate, and the initial quarterly payment would be due within 30 days of binding, Ung said in a letter to the board. Butler told Ung he plans to pay for the property insurance from the county's self-liability fund. That fund is budgeted at $1.4 million for FY25. Board member Jeremy Taylor expressed concerns regarding how to pay the insurance premium. Taylor said currently the self-liability fund has a negative balance of $310,000. He said the annual expense for the fund this year was $1.26 million, totaling $1.6 million in spending from the liability fund. The math doesn't add up. You're short about $177,000 or $200,000. There's no coincidence. It wasn't budgeted. It wasn't budgeted. It's going to come out of reserves, Taylor said. Butler said the funding for the insurance will come from the self-liability fund. He said the current deficit in the fund is due to a higher-than-expected property insurance bill, and the county has not raised the tax, asking enough to cover expenses. Quote, if we would have been taxing the way we should have been for the liability fund, we wouldn't have the problem we have today, he said. Butler added that they cannot predict whether or not the property insurance will go up again. Taylor previously proposed the county cut back on the county's maintenance and repair fund for the law enforcement center. The county has budgeted $170,000 for a maintenance and repair fund in the building services department for FY25. The county will also provide funding for an LEC Authority Maintenance Fund. When the new law enforcement center is operating, it will receive payment for housing federal inmates. the county will pay 20% of revenues from housing extra inmates into a maintenance and improvement fund for the jail. The fund has a maximum amount of $8 million. Taylor said because the county will fund a, quote, maintenance fund for the law enforcement center as well as a building services LEC maintenance fund, they will be double taxing citizens. Taylor proposed using the $170,000 county maintenance and repair fund to cover the insurance and rely on the LEC authority maintenance fund. Other board members expressed that they would not support the idea. Ung shared the building services LEC maintenance budget covers items such as cleaning supplies, tools, utilities, inspections, permits, etc. The LEC maintenance funds are for repairs and replacements at the facility, according to the lease. Next story from the front page. Entering the Vortex. Film festival planners hope it showcases Best of Vermillion. And it shows a photo of a woman in front of a popcorn machine and pop machine. It's Shannon Cole, executive director of the Vermillion Cultural Association, posing in the lobby of their Coyote Twin Theater in Vermillion, South Dakota. They will hold their inaugural Vortex Film Festival at the theater in September. When Vermillion hosts what's billed as the first ever film festival this fall, it will indirectly have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2 to thank. For years, Vermillion Cultural Association Executive Director Shannon Cole had conversations with her board about bringing some sort of celebration to the college town, but the plan really materialized in 2023 when the Coyote Twin, which the VCA oversees, sponsored a screening of the Southern Fried Horror Flick for the annual SuperCon Film Festival in Sioux Falls. The event's organizers, Casey Kelderman and Sam Lenz, went to do a cross-promotion in Vermillion and raised the idea of a film festival. I said, why, you don't say, Cole joked. Recently announced, the inaugural Vortex Film Festival will run from September 20 through September 22, largely at the Coyote Twin Theater, though Cole said there have been conversations with the VCA's partners at the University of South Dakota and the AV Lounge. Artist submissions to Vortex Film Festival can be made up until Saturday, July 20, via the Film Freeway website. Before July comes, Cole said, the plan is to build a poster and develop possible t-shirt ideas. Once July hits, there will be screenings of all the potential competitors, so a schedule can be announced in August. When we look at it statewide, there are very successful film festivals in South Dakota. It would be easy to say they've got it and we don't need to worry about it. But we've got a theater and have everything we need to make it happen, Cole said. Our focus is on making Vermillion an arts and culture hub, and it's all toward that mission. The name Vortex is rooted in a local joke about Vermillion being a vortex, drawing people back to the town over and over again, Cole said. The ambition of the organizers, then, is that the Vortex Film Festival will draw folks back to Vermillion year after year. Part of the model for the film festival will be the Fools 48 short film project that Vermillion hosts each April, in which local teams have exactly 2 days to write, film, and edit a 4 to 7 minute picture before screening them. Cole said the 2024 entries for Fools 48 will screen at the Vortex Film Festival. Kelderman and Lenz have judged the showcase before and were impressed by the attendance in a town of about 12,000 people. They think it could be a positive sign for the fall. It was a lot of people. The townspeople of Vermillion really showed up. And I think attendance is one of the first keys I would look at for success, Lenz said. Both Lenz and Kelderman said the idea of so many different firsts is what appealed to them about helping shepherd an entirely new film festival. The cool thing is this is going to be the first time I've worked in a theatrical setting for a film fest or putting on a film screening, Kelderman said. This is our first time working in an actual theatrical setting, and we get 2 screens to work with. As for Lenz, quote, I'm a big fan of building things from the ground up. I like starting from scratch, and right now it feels like there are no rules. We get to define what this fest means, and we're still honing in on that. With it being the maiden voyage, Kelderman and Lentz, who host a film podcast together, said they want to make sure the Vortex is a uniquely Midwestern film festival, with as many movies from artists in Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota as possible. Quote, "Our film festival is focused on Midwest filmmakers and showcasing that you can make a film here," Kelderman said. "The biggest win would be having filmmakers there in attendance that can see their movie on the big screen." Lentz's hope for a number is 100 or more submissions, which he said is doable. "The thing that I like to focus on is selecting the right movies and putting those together in a way that makes sense," Lentz said. "Programming the films is a thing you wouldn't think would take too much time, but depending on how many submissions you get, watching all those movies and piecing them together, not only what we're going to play, but in what order, that's my favorite part of the process." "I'm hoping we get 50 submissions," Kelderman said. Cole isn't playing a numbers game. "We're really just trying to get the movies on screen this year. We will have a kickoff with a featured film and speaker, an opening reception," she said. Cole is also envisioning the festival being able to direct visitors to local restaurants and stores as a kind of synergy. Quote, "Vermilion has done so much growing just since I moved here," Cole said. "I think it will surprise people to see how lively the town is and how happy people are. People love being in Vermilion. We're a very proud town. That energy is infectious. It makes people want to come back and experience being here and getting involved with the community." And turning to local news, bond set for shooting suspect. A South Sioux City man who died in a shooting early Saturday appears to have been shot unintentionally, court documents show. South Sioux City police have identified the man who died as Javier Nunez Gustav, age 23, of South Sioux City. Tobias Thomas, age 23, of Sioux City, was arrested Saturday and charged with manslaughter, which is a Class 2A felony punishable by up to 20 years in prison. At Thomas's first appearance on Tuesday in Dakota County Court, Judge Edward Matney set the bond at $350,000 and scheduled a preliminary hearing for May 22nd. South Sioux City police were summoned to the Flatwater Crossing Apartments, located at 2800 Flatwater Drive, at 4:23 a.m., after receiving a report of a shooting. Nunez Gustav was found in his apartment with a single gunshot wound to the chest and was not breathing when officers and emergency personnel arrived. He was pronounced dead at the scene. According to an arrest affidavit filed on Monday, Thomas told police that he and Nunez Gustav had purchased alcohol around 11 p.m. Friday and were drinking in Nunez Gustav's apartment. Tobias said Nunez Gustav was sitting at the end of a sectional couch, cleaning his guns, while Thomas stood and watched. Nunez Gustav showed Thomas a 9mm Glock 43 handgun he had fixed and then handed it to him. Thomas said the gun discharged as he was holding it, asking Nunez Gustav if that just happened. Nunez Gustav began to pass out and Thomas called 911 for help. Investigators recovered the gun and a single spent shell casing at the scene. Police recovered two rifles and a shotgun on a kitchen counter, and another rifle on the sectional. The Glock and a second handgun were recovered from a living room table, along with gun cleaning tools and supplies. Thomas submitted to a breath test about an hour later, and the results showed a 0.111% alcohol content. That's above the legal limit of 0.08%. South Sioux City police are awaiting the final results of an autopsy, but do not anticipate filing additional charges, a police spokesperson said on Wednesday. Funeral set for David Schultz. Funeral services have been set for Walt Lake trucker David Schultz, whose body was found last week in a field 5 months after his disappearance. Services begin at 10 a.m. May 10th at the Peace Lutheran Church in Walt Lake, with a visitation from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on May 9th. Family will be present at the visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. The funeral services are being handled by the Farber and Ottoman Funeral Home in Sac City. The funeral will be live streamed on the Farber and Ottoman's Facebook page. Schultz, age 53, was found the afternoon of April 25 in a field near the intersection of Union Avenue and 190th Street in rural Sac County, not far from where his abandoned semi-truck was found. He had been missing since November 21, when his Peterbilt semi was found parked in the middle of the northbound lane of County Road N14, Union Avenue, not far from where it intersects with D15, which is 190th Street. Preliminary forensic autopsy results conducted by the Iowa Office of the State Medical Examiner found no signs of trauma or serious injury, and foul play was not suspected. Through a spokesman, the family said last week that they will arrange to have a second autopsy performed. Quote, "Together, David's parents and I made funeral arrangements," said Schultz's widow, Sarah, in a Facebook post on Tuesday. "I hope that we can find out exactly what happened, but in the meantime, please understand that we need time to switch gears from missing him to mourning him." And now in briefs, a Sanborn, Iowa man pleaded not guilty Wednesday to robbing a Sanborn bank. Dell Evans Jr., age 40, is charged in U.S. District Court in Sioux City with one count of bank robbery. Evans is accused of walking into Sanborn Savings Bank on January 22nd and handing a teller a note demanding money. No weapons were displayed, and the robber left the bank on foot with $5,308 in cash. Using bank workers' descriptions of the robber, police immediately developed Evans as a suspect because he had been released from federal prison in November after serving a 15-year sentence for bank robbery and other charges and had two bank robbery convictions. Evans was taken into custody without incident later in the day at his home, located three blocks from the bank. According to court documents, Evans identified himself as the man seen in the surveillance camera footage obtained from the bank. Authorities executed a search warrant at his home and seized a shoebox containing $4,808 in cash. Evans told police he had given $500 to his brother, who denied accepting the money, court documents said. Evans was initially charged in O'Brien County with robbery and theft. Those charges were dismissed after Evans was indicted in federal court. Our next brief. A total of seven people were arrested for prostitution, an aggravated misdemeanor, during an undercover operation recently conducted by the Sioux City Police Department. The operation took place on April 16 and 23. After an ad on a known escort website was created, police say those charged engaged in conversation with a detective and agreed to meet in a hotel room in the 4200 block of South Lakeport Street. They further agreed to exchange money for a sex act with an undercover officer, according to documents filed in the Woodbury County District Court. The following people were arrested for prostitution: Dustin W. Foreman, age 40, of Sioux City; David D. Einerwald, age 54, of Orange City; Scott H. Sherbon, age 59, of Maquoketa; Bao Kwok Lee, age 30, of Sioux City; Stephen P. Joyce, age 53, of Dakota Dunes; Albertico Quezada, age 41, of Dakota City; and a 17-year-old male of South Sioux City. Community Policing Sergeant Tom Gill said the police department's Special Investigations Unit conducts these types of operations several times a year. Our next brief. The Sioux City Chamber Music will be presenting the Young Artist Competition as its final concert of the season, 2 p.m. Sunday at the First Presbyterian Church on Nebraska Street. Morningside University Music Education Director Josh Nanstad will lead the live Young Artist Competition, which will include students from the 6th to 12th grade competing for a monetary prize. This year's students are Jessica Zhang on cello, Joyce Zhang violin, Hannah Kohler clarinet, Kiana Jones, cello, Vincent Colling on piano, Angelica Jones on viola, and Noah Reichs on trombone. Single admission adult tickets are available at the door. All students will be admitted at no cost. Turning to the state page, lost objects found far from Nebraska's tornado zone. This is from the Omaha World Herald. Lisa Seaman lost her son Aspen in 2016. She doesn't want to lose friends and family's memories of him, too. Their memories were written in a journal, tucked in a zip-closed bag inside a sturdy black plastic tote at his gravesite at Prospect Hill Cemetery in Elkhorn. A picture of Aspen, who drowned when he was 3 years old, was on the front of the tote. The tornado that blew through Friday knocked down his 10-foot gravestone and scattered some of the items around it. I went out to the cemetery the day after the storm and tried to look. The damage is so substantial, it's kind of an overwhelming thing to even start looking. Seaman posted about her search on the Nebraska-Iowa 2024 Tornado Lost and Found Facebook page. Scores of others are doing the same. One family was searching for a baby blanket, another for a cross-stitch picture. Others, like Seaman, are missing urns and grave markers. J.C. Zawadny of Mapleton, Iowa, said so many people were finding pictures and other mementos in her area that she started sharing them on her Facebook page. Interest was so high that Bryce Jensen of Mobile started the Lost and Found page. So far, 60 people have been connected, and she and Jensen are doing some investigating to find the owners of even more. If someone posts a cheerleading photo, they'll try to figure out the school and contact an alumni group. A yearbook photo yields other clues that they've chased down. Zawadny says it's personal for her after experiencing the devastation of a tornado in Mapleton 13 years ago. "We had that tornado here and people showed up in droves," she said. "I was really emotional that night when people were posting baby pictures and wedding pictures, and I thought, I've got to do something. People have been amazed at how far things have flown after the storm." Austin Hazard of Otto, Iowa, was walking outside to feed his horses and cows Friday evening when something floated down in front of him. It was a picture, which he's since learned flew all the way from Blair, Nebraska, nearly 70 miles away. He posted the photo on his Facebook page. It was shared many times. Within 24 hours, he had found who had lost it. "I had an overwhelming response," he said. "It's already in the mail." Haley Hayworth found a canceled check at her parents' house on Rock Branch, about 90 miles from Blair. It belonged to Dan Lahan, as did a baptism certificate that an acquaintance found. They are also being returned to the family. Austin Wilcox is still looking for the owners of pictures he found in his yard and cornfield in Anthon, Iowa, and he posted them on his Facebook page. "Hopefully someone sees it," he said. Some items have landed near damaged homes and are being turned in at the relevant center in the Elkhorn area. Three tables there are filled with pictures. The more expensive items are being kept in the offices. "People just started bringing in stuff," said lead pastor Ronnie Rothke. "For someone to find their valuables, it's a needle in a haystack." There have been some successes, he said. A couple came in looking for some lost items and were overjoyed to find that someone had turned in one of their wedding rings and some credit cards. They lived right across the street, Roth said. Their house was destroyed. Seaman said she understands that the journaled memories of her son may not seem as important to someone losing their home, but that journal had cherished entries. "Losing a child is the worst imaginable tragedy anyone can suffer," she said. "It would mean everything for me to find it," she wrote on her Facebook post. A related story about the tornadoes, Dateline Omaha. Volunteers pile up debris in Nebraska and Iowa tornado cleanup, but monetary donations are preferred. As Omaha Mayor Gene Stothert prepared to give an update on storm cleanup Monday afternoon, Tim Anderson and Russ Wilt backed a trailer full of branches to a growing pile of tree debris at Greenbrier Park in Elkhorn. The branches came from Ramblewood, which is a neighborhood ravaged by Friday's tornado. This was the fifth trailer load that Anderson and Wilt dropped off Monday. Their employer, DTM, gave them the day off to serve the community. But it wasn't Anderson's only contribution to the cleanup. Sunday, he and his daughter Ava had picked up 7 trailer loads. Throughout eastern Nebraska and western Iowa, both volunteers and paid workers continued to clean up after Friday's storms. So many people have been willing to help that in some cases, officials have urged the public to back off. Authorities in Pottawatomie County asked Monday that no groups or individuals travel to Minden, Iowa, to help with the recovery efforts unless they have received prior approval. A tornado that hit Minden destroyed about 80 houses, including the home of Nicholas Ring, age 63, who died Saturday at an Omaha hospital from his injuries. A town of about 600 people in the northern part of the county, Minden remains closed to the general public due to the amount of significant debris and the operation of heavy equipment. One of the current challenges facing response and recovery efforts is the influx of resources that have not been requested, the county press release said. Current response efforts include provisions for meal availability, water and hydration, medical support and operational tools, heavy equipment and resources sufficient for the coming week's operations. Instead, Pottawatomie officials said they strongly encourage people to make monetary donations. This will allow the ability to purchase goods that match the needs identified by disaster survivors in seeking assistance. Donations can be made to the Southwest Iowa Emergency Relief Fund to support areas impacted through the region at Southwest Iowa Relief Fund. If you wish to have your donation designated to the community of Minden, a special fund is being established, and information on how to make that donation will be announced in the coming days. In Nebraska, Governor Jim Pillen also urged financial support. For now, he said, the best way to help is to donate money to organizations helping displaced families. Plenty of volunteers worked on the cleanup over the weekend, he said, but he predicted there will be a need for volunteers throughout the summer and fall to continue the work of cleanup and rebuilding. Volunteers interested in providing cleanup assistance should contact Omaha Rapid Response, and that is, the website is rapidresponseamerica.org. That organization is helping to coordinate volunteer efforts in Elkhorn and many other areas. Washington County residents in need of volunteer assistance with cleanup or other debris removal services can report to the Salvation Army at the Lakeland Community Center, which is located at County Road 34 and Nebraska 133. Volunteers may apply for work details at that location from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily until further notice. Donations of clothing, shoes, food, and other personal items may be taken to the First Lutheran Church located at 2146 Wright Street in Blair, Nebraska. The Red Cross is helping facilitate these donations with the church. At Elkhorn's Greenbrier Park on Monday, Anderson said he was glad to be part of the effort. He recalled that he had wanted to help with the cleanup after Omaha's notorious 1975 tornado, but he was just 14 years old at the time and his father wouldn't let him. So he had extra motivation to help out this time. "We're just helping out, just doing what we can to help our neighbors," said Anderson, whose own Elkhorn area home escaped damage on Friday. As Anderson and Wilt tossed branches with help from City of Omaha worker Nick Flynn, they marveled at how many volunteers were working over the weekend. "There would be like 40 people in a line carrying stuff and tossing it into a pile to be hauled away," Wilt said. Stothert lauded the myriad volunteers as well as the first responders and other city workers. "It just really shows what community really means," she said. "It's people coming together and helping each other. So many volunteers were out there. In fact, in some areas, there were more volunteers than we really knew what to do with." Cleanup operations are progressing, she said. The city provided the free tree debris site and a dump site for storm-damaged appliances at Greenbrier Park, and 10 city dump trucks in the Ramblewood area are helping people pick up construction debris so that the city can haul it away. Meanwhile, Waste Management has extended its hours of operation at the Pheasant Point Landfill on 216th Street in Bennington, extended its hours until 6 p.m. every day through Saturday, according to a spokeswoman for Douglas County. To be accepted at the landfill, tree limbs must be cut into pieces that are 4 feet or smaller. The debris can be mixed. Household appliances, waste tires, and hazardous materials such as waste oil, paint in liquid, paint, lead acid batteries are not accepted. Dried out paint can be accepted. City officials are already looking ahead to reconstruction. Our message to everybody that was really affected is what the city wants to do is help them get back in their houses as soon as possible, she said. She said the city plans to waive any type of city permit fees for people rebuilding after the storm. We will try to prioritize any type of permits and inspections that we can, she said. But the one thing we want to put out a warning about is don't fall for some scammers that have already come into town that will say they can get the job done without a permit. Because those permits and inspections are really important. They're all about safety. As her press conference wrapped up, James Johnson and his son Braylon backed up their pickup truck with a load of tree debris from the neighborhood, Arbor Ridge, and nearby Ramblewood. It's great that people are pulling together, James Johnson said. You just come together as a community, he said. That's what we do in the Midwest. That's what we are known for. And then there's a photo of volunteers digging through giant piles of debris. And then a sweet photo of father and son James and Braylon Johnson as they dropped off their tree debris from their Elkhorn neighborhood. And turning to the opinion page in the journal today, it shows Snoopy on his doghouse with his fighter pilot helmet on, and his doghouse is riddled with bullets. And Linus has a thought bubble that says, wow, the Red Baron did a lot of damage. And then Charlie Brown has a thought bubble that says, it was a Christy Noem drive-by. Our first opinion comes from Eugene Robinson, who writes for the Washington Post. He writes, tent cities will go away, but not passion for Palestinians. The pro-Palestinian encampment at George Washington University was quiet Monday morning. No bullhorns, no speeches, no chanting. The night before had been loud, as students removed barricades blocking the entrances to University Yard and added dozens of tents to those already there. The useless metal barriers were piled in the center of the quad, with a Palestinian flag planted on top. A handful of campus police officers watched from the periphery. Washington's police department, having declined a request from university officials Friday to forcibly clear the area, had a significant presence in the surrounding neighborhood, but mostly kept a low profile. Many of the tents were unoccupied. A few protesters, books in hand, appeared to be cramming for finals. The hateful anti-Semitism that has animated some of the campus protests across the nation is outrageous and appalling. I saw none of that during my brief visit to the GWU campus. I also saw no acknowledgement that Hamas had started the Gaza war with a terrorist attack on Israeli civilians, the worst slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. And I saw no displays of sympathy for the scores of brutalized hostages, including five Americans, that Hamas still holds. The student protesters are selective in their outrage. But don't ignore or dismiss them. The tent cities will eventually go away, but this passion for the Palestinian cause will endure. What we're seeing may be a generational shift in attitudes toward the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. These protests and occupations are happening not just at Ivy League universities such as Columbia and Harvard, but also at public schools such as Ohio State University, Indiana University, Arizona State University, and Cal Poly Humboldt. 12 protesters, most of them students, were arrested Saturday as police cleared a pro-Palestinian encampment at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. More than 1,000 arrests have been made so far across the country. As Buffalo Springfield sang in 1966, "There's something happening here. but what it is ain't exactly clear. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Those words were written at a time when student-led protests against the Vietnam War were growing nationwide. As Mark Twain is reputed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. There are obvious differences between then and now, but echoes of that earlier era, are in the fervor of the pro-Palestinian protests and in the generational divide that they illustrate. A poll in February by the Pew Research Center found that 33% of U.S. adults under 30 said they sympathize more with the Palestinians, while just 14% said they sympathize more with the Israelis. An additional 21% said they sympathize equally with both sides. By contrast, all age groups over 30 sympathized more with the Israelis. A Harvard Public Opinion Project survey conducted last month found that adults under 30 who support a permanent ceasefire in the Israel-Gaza war outnumber those who oppose a ceasefire, 5-1. Is anti-Semitism responsible for these attitudes? Clearly, it plays a role. At some of the campus protests, the word Zionist has been used as an epithet in a way that denies Israel's right to exist. In some cases, Jewish counter-protesters or bystanders have been insulted, treated roughly, and even spat on. All of this is completely unacceptable. And if the pro-Palestinian student movement does not cleanse itself of anti-Semitic elements, I hope it quickly perishes. But I don't think the students in their tent villages are all anti-Semitic. Many do seem ignorant of important historical events. My father and all of my uncles served in the military during World War II. The Holocaust happened before I was born, so it is history to me, but it is ancient history to the current generation of students. I'm also old enough to remember the important and supportive role that Jewish allies played in the civil rights movement that delivered African Americans from second-class citizenship. The students do know some truths, though, and then it has some bullets. First bullet, Palestinians were dispossessed of their homes and property. Next bullet, Israel is strong and the Palestinians are weak. Next bullet, the Israeli government under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu shows no interest in a just peace. Next bullet, tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. Young adults grow up to be middle-aged adults with money and authority. In the coming years, the Palestinian cause is likely to have more powerful supporters in the United States than ever before. And that was from Eugene Robinson, who writes for the Washington Post. A related opinion piece comes from Jonah Goldberg, who is editor-in-chief of thedispatch.com. What we keep getting wrong about campus protests. The current campus demonstrations are a reminder that all of the mossy cliches and puffed-up pieties of polite and impolite American discourse, the sanctity of protest is the hardest to question. Doubting the loftiness of protests invites elite scorn more than any other skepticism about a constitutional right. Proposing limits on free speech, for example, attracts far less outrage. Indeed, people question free speech all the time, in debates about hate speech, campaign finance, social media, and more. But if I say that most protests are performative cosplay or mass meetups of the angry, the radical, the lonely, or the misinformed, someone is bound to point to the civil rights protests of the 60s, or the campaign for women's suffrage, followed by a string of righteous how dare yous. This gets to part of my objection. Nothing is inherently good or bad about protesting. Organized protest is a form of speech, and like speech, it is rightly protected by the First Amendment. But also, like speech, its morality, though not its legality, is wholly dependent on the content. You have a right to say or protest for awful things. Invoking that right doesn't make your view any nobler. The Jim Crow era civil rights protests were noble because the cause was noble. They did not prove that protesting is always good, merely that it can be. Replace the March on Washington with the Nazi March on Skokie, Illinois, and you get the point. The aesthetics and psychology of protest are often ugly because crowds encourage extremism and intimidation. The core message of mass protest is strength in numbers, a primordial feeling that can often lead to a kind of illiberal power drunkenness. The hallucinations of alcoholics provide us with an opportunity to study crowds as they appear in the minds of individuals. Elias Canetti wrote in his brilliant book, Crowds and Power. Some argue that democracy is all about strength in numbers, and that's partly true. But democratic will is exercised by the private actions of individual voters casting secret ballots. The strength in numbers invoked by most large protests, is better understood as populism, and populism has an uglier history than democracy, from the long history of race riots to January 6th. The irreducible political unit in America is the individual, not the crowd. The highest form of protest and speech is captured by Norman Rockwell's famous painting of a lone working-class dissenter standing up for his conscience as his neighbors listen politely, not by images of mobs shouting insults, blocking traffic, occupying buildings, or worse. Not all protests are ugly riots or mass tantrums, but tolerance, often shown for both, is a product of romantic impulses driven by 1960s nostalgia. As a generation, progressive baby boomers take a back seat to nobody in their stunning self-regard and overestimation of their historical importance. But these people have shaped the narratives of academia, entertainment, and journalism. They've convinced themselves and the young minds they shape that protest is self-justifying, a rite of passage of enlightened youth. I could have salted this column with examples of today's protesters revealing how precious little they know about the issues supposedly motivating them. But my point isn't about these protests in particular. It's about the broader cult of protest. The nostalgic champions of the campus protests of the 60s would have Americans believe that they were a heroic success, stopping the Vietnam War. But what they actually helped achieve was Richard Nixon's election and 7 more years of war. Performative protest feels good for those drunk on their own, unearned sense of importance. But such spectacles are often terrible for their intended ends. That's one more reason not to glorify protest for its own sake. And that was from Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of thedispatch.com. And staying with the opinion page, here's another view from the Wall Street Journal. President will debate when? Is President Joe Biden going to debate Donald Trump as the November election nears? Quote, I am, somewhere, I don't know when, Biden said last week in an interview with Howard Stern. I'm happy to debate him, he said. Nice to hear, though we'll believe it when we see it. If the 81-year-old president wants to skip the stage this fall, Trump's refusal to debate his GOP primary opponents has handed Biden an easy excuse. Now Trump, who is 77, is demanding to debate early and often because he wants to suggest that Biden isn't up to taking hard questions. Well, is he? Since Biden took office, according to Politico, he's given interviews to only 2 print reporters. He speaks only to friendly venues like Stern's radio show. Biden's forceful performance at the State of the Union was designed to dispel the idea that his next move ought to be retirement. Yet 63% of voters still think his public appearances give credibility to the fears about his age and memory, the Harvard-Harris poll found in March. The White House insists Biden is as vigorous and capable as ever. When the New York Post asked why Biden has taken to wearing tennis shoes with his suits, this was the comment from Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates. Quote, I know y'all aren't partial to presidents who exercise, but don't worry, you'll get used to it, unquote. More likely, they're afraid that the president will fall. Trump is ready to debate, quote, anywhere, anytime, any place, he wrote on the internet. Biden won't take the bait, but if he truly wants to debate, he should formally agree to somewhere, sometime, someplace. Otherwise, voters might decide that Trump is right about him. Here's another view from the Albany Times Union entitled, Don't Speed Prison Closures. To prepare for shutdowns, communities in New York, where correctional facilities are economic lifelines, need time and help from the state. New York's prison population dropped by roughly half since 2008 and is projected to continue falling. Against that backdrop, closing prisons makes fiscal and common sense. So it was welcome news that lawmakers are going ahead with a plan to close up to 5 prisons this year. The move will save the state millions of dollars. But lawmakers and others who object to the plan raise a compelling point when they say that the state's 3-month notification requirement does not provide communities with the time needed to prepare for the coming economic blow. Some lawmakers and prison employees have pushed for a 6-month notification requirement that seems more than reasonable. New York's prison population exploded after the state enacted the so-called Rockefeller drug laws in the 1970s. That led to a boom in prison construction. The injustice needed to end, but that doesn't mean that closing prisons is painless. And since the state pushed prisons as economic development, it must help communities now that it is taking that economic lifeline away. And on the business page, Taco the Town. La Juanita plans to open second Sioux City location. Tacos La Juanita, the popular Sioux City Metro Mexican restaurant, plans to open its second location in Sioux City and its 5th overall. The restaurant will be in the brick building formerly occupied by the Half Moon Bar and Grill at 714 South Louis Boulevard. Eric Aguinaga, who will manage the taqueria with wife Nalelli, said renovations will hopefully begin in May. An opening date for the new La Juanita has not been set. At the moment, we're about to start the project, and just pretty much as long as it takes from there till then, Aguinaga told the Journal. I don't want to give an exact date, but if I had to put one, I'd say maybe mid to end of June. The existing La Juanita location in Sioux City is on Pierce Street. The others are in South Sioux City, Lamar's, and Storm Lake. The restaurant has legions of devotees. At the South Sioux City location, located at 116 East 21st Street, cars often snake around the block to get into the drive-thru. The Half Moon Bar, which had been in the Lewis Boulevard building for years, closed permanently last fall. Quote, we think you'll be happy with the new business that is entering, the proprietors of the Half Moon wrote in a Facebook post in November, announcing the closure and that La Juanita would be moving in there. The building was sold that month to Eric Aguinaga's father, Martin Diaz Aguinaga, for $475,000, according to county property records. The father and son are part of the family that has operated La Juanita for nearly 3 decades. The new La Juanita will have indoor seating and a drive-through, Eric Aguinaga said. Its hours will be 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Thursday, and 9 a.m. to 1 a.m. Friday and Saturday nights. And some business briefs. Keith Volstedt, M.D., Mercy One Western Iowa Chief Medical Officer, has been elected to the Iowa Medical Society Board of Directors, Mercy One announced in a press release this week. Volstedt, a University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine graduate, has served the Greater Sioux City area as a surgeon for over 30 years. Members of the Iowa Medical Society elected Volstedt as one of 3 newly appointed board members at the group's annual meeting April 19 in Des Moines. The Iowa Medical Society, established in 1850, is the largest and oldest statewide professional association for Iowa physicians, representing over 6,000 members, according to the press release. And the Alzheimer's Association Iowa chapter has awarded Chris Craighead 2024 Volunteer of the Year for her work on the Wine and Chocolate Festival in Sioux City. Craighead is a member of the Sioux City Wine and Chocolate Committee. Over the last 2 years, She has helped secure sponsorships from those who hadn't recently participated in the event and managed all of the live and silent auction items and social media campaign, according to a press release from the Alzheimer's Association Iowa chapter. She also helped forge a connection between the June E. Nyland Cancer Center and the Alzheimer's Association that is paving the way for the Cancer Center to eventually help perform PET scans for those in need in the Siouxland area, according to the press release. And that's all the time we have for the Sioux City Journal today, May 2nd, Thursday, May 2nd, 2024. You've been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm Mary Francis. It's been my pleasure to read for you. Have a great day.